version. This is how many of those time units it should take for the record to go around once. All right? Okay, and the distances and the frequencies of the pulsars are also given in those same time units. This is a diagram of the waveform of a typical portion of the recording within the picture section. They may need a little bit of help to figure out how to reconstruct these pictures. And so here is what the waveform looks like. Here is a diagram which indicates that you are to go back to the beginning every certain time. And if you do that and convert that to a visual scanning back and forth across the picture like this, and it tells you there how long you should take for one scan before you go back, then the first picture ought to look like that. And that first picture is nothing but a simple circle. It's intended for calibration. After that, you get into the real pictures. Question?
Yes. Given you were saying that we just don't even have enough data to make speculation on the relative abundances of life in the universe, how really rational would it be to assume they even have ears?
Sure, sure. And if they have ears, suppose they don't listen to the same frequency range
right.
that we do.
Right.
And a question that I asked is, suppose they live in an atmosphere with a different molecular weight than ours. Everybody knows what your voice sounds like after you breathe helium, right? Well, if you don't know, you sound like Donald Duck. The helium molecule, well, the helium atom, is lighter than the atoms in the air that you're used to, and it turns out that has the effect of increasing frequencies. I talked to Amal Shakashiri, who was the assistant to the person who really did more than anything else in putting this record together, and that was Frank Drake. Everybody seems to think it was Carl Sagan. He never said that it was, but everybody assumes that it's him because he was on the committee and everybody knows he's into this kind of stuff. In fact, it was Frank Drake's idea of using the recording in the first place. You can get far more information onto a sound recording than you can almost any other medium that would occupy the same space and weight. And also, it seemed appropriate because the year of the launch was the 100th anniversary of the invention of the phonograph record by Thomas Edison. So they're commemorating that as well. And Amal Shakashiri was the person who did a lot of the work of actually putting the things together. In fact, she is the Arabic voice in the Greek section in the 55 languages. And she also was responsible for tracing down speakers on the Cornell campus of all the different languages and so on. It's pretty easy to find them in a big university. You've got a world culture, you've got people from all over the earth. And so they got all 20 major languages of earth, the ones that are spoken by the greatest numbers of people, and a good sampling of the others, from ancient Sumerian all the way up to a little kid using modern English at the very end. Hello to the children of planet Earth. The greetings are banal, and the reason for that was they were not trained announcers, and the feeling was that they might go to pieces if they were asked to read some high literature or something like that. So they were encouraged to be informal and just say, you know, some simple greeting on the order of hello, how are you? And some of them are very short. French is one word, bonjour, which means hello, and some of them are a little bit longer than that. And then they did get other speakers of the same languages to listen to all of them, make sure that nobody had snuck in some obscene remark in a caddy or something like that. And in fact, nobody had. Well, I talked to her about all these problems, and, you know, I mean, what can you do but shrug your shoulders and say, yes, there's that possibility, but if nothing else, they'll learn some things about the nature of our senses by observing what this recording is like. You know, and I asked her the question about molecular weight in the atmosphere. She didn't know the answer, and she went and asked Frank Drake, and he said it would have any effect. Now, I didn't get to talk to him myself, and I was a little bit annoyed with the whole thing, actually. But, you know, she claimed that he said, and I'm not sure that after the question was relayed that way, he understood it correctly, but, you know, for what it's worth, that might be the case. Well, so much for Voyager. Now, this is the final thing that I want to tell you about, and that is what comes next.
What comes next, if the politicians do not kill it, and they are actively trying to right now, particularly Representative Boland, who is the chairman of the House Appropriations Committee, and who is less enthusiastic about space, and of course very powerful being in that position, is Jupiter Orbiter Probe, which, as the painting here shows, would be the first planetary mission to be launched from the space shuttle.
Jupiter Orbiter Probe, as the name implies, would consist of two parts, rather like Pioneer Venus, except they would be a single launch. Pioneer Venus, the two spacecraft, are launched separately. One of the spacecraft would go into orbit around Jupiter and would look something like this. I don't guarantee it's the exact configuration, but there's a lot of thinking already been done about it. It'd be somewhat close to that. And then on the way into Jupiter, before it goes into orbit, it would release a probe, a single probe. Now that's not enough, obviously, to cover the complexity of the meteorology that must be going on that planet. But it is as many as they felt they could get the money for, frankly. That's what it boils down to. Even Pioneer Venus, which is studying the simplest meteorology in the solar system deliberately, starting with the simplest one to try to understand it, uses four probes, and you can count the buses as a sort of fifth, and they'd love to have more if they could get them. And, you know, one probe for Jupiter isn't enough, but it will teach us very much more than we know now. Please note that I use the word probe. You don't talk about a lander here, as you did in Viking. You talk about a probe. There's nothing to land on in Jupiter. It's all gases and liquids. But you can go into the atmosphere as far down as possible, and before the probe was finally destroyed, here you see it on its way into the atmosphere just after it has released the heat shield, which slowed it down as it came into the upper atmosphere of Jupiter at an enormous speed. You know, Jupiter has the strongest gravity of any planet in the solar system, and so you have a tremendous amount of friction. It releases the heat shield, and a parachute comes out, and that slows it, and it gets some distance under the clouds before the pressure and the increasing temperature from the interior of Jupiter begin to destroy it. In some ways, Pioneer Venus is a dress rehearsal for this Jupiter Orbiter Probe mission. Well, its importance is twofold. Number one, it will tell us a great deal about the planet. The probe will tell us what the atmosphere is made of and give us a good deal of the structure. When I say what it's made of, or I've been telling you all even what it's made of, we're talking about minor constituents here, and they can be important as well. And the orbiter will not only enable us to examine Jupiter continuously over a long period, instead of just grabbing what we can as we fly past. That's pretty good in the case of the Voyager. Those cameras are so good on the Voyager, not just the orbiter here, but on the Voyager, just fly past Jupiter, that they will begin taking pictures of Jupiter 2 months out from the planet. And already those pictures will be better than the best Earth-based pictures of Jupiter through our best telescope. 10 days out from the planet, the pictures will be better, which means 10 days on either side, 20 days altogether, 3 weeks, the pictures will be better than the best of Pioneer 11. And at the middle, at the closest encounter, the Voyager pictures will be so detailed that it will take dozens of them just to fill the red spot. You know, so you are impressed, I hope, with the Pioneer 10 and 11 pictures, but you just ain't seen nothing yet. We will get something of the order of 200,000 pictures of Jupiter and its moon from each spacecraft, from each flyby. Compare that to 21 pictures of Mars and Mariner 4 of 1965. Well, much though that will be, it still only gives you a period of observation of Jupiter of about 4 months. You get it for a little less than 2 months actually on the way in, and about a month and a half on the way out. That's quite a lot, especially since we will have a full disk color photograph of the planet every day during that 4 month period. That is going to make quite the time lapse movie. They will take the pictures, so the same face of Jupiter is towards the spacecraft every day. So the movie will show whether this is developing and moving around the face of Jupiter. That's one of the many things we're looking forward to from Voyager for just sheer visual glee. And, you know, at such time as it exists, I'll come back and show you now. The orbiter, though, will be able to do it for a much longer period than that, probably something in the order of several Earth years. In addition, the orbiter will be able to make multiple close flybys of all of the five inner moons of Jupiter. So instead of just getting one flyby, maybe from Voyager 1 and another maybe from Voyager 2, we will have over and over and over again, one after another, incredibly complex orbital trajectory calculations. Because what you do is you use the gravity of each moon to send you on to the next place that you're going. And so you have multiple gravities using the moon as well as Jupiter itself in this incredible years-long game of celestial billiards using the spacecraft as the billiard ball and
and gravity for the various bodies as the equivalent of the size of the table, it's going to be a fantastic thing to see.
What are they going to use on the flyby when they do take pictures of Jupiter to make that time lapse? Photography, what are they going to use for a reference point, a theoretical meridian or a feature? Are they going to pick a feature?
I don't know what they're using as a reference point. I would assume it would be a constant either system 1 or system 2 longitude. It would be kind of silly to use system 3, I should think. That doesn't refer to atmospheric features.
What it's referring to is since everything that we see on Jupiter is an atmospheric feature, a weather system, and different winds occur at different latitudes as they do on Europe. You know, we have easterly in one latitude, westerly in another. The rotation period, in quotes, of the planet, that is the length of time it takes for a given cloud feature to go around, is determined not just by how fast the planet is, but also by what the winds have to be at that level. It turns out there are two major wind systems, not too surprising, the prevailing easterlies and prevailing westerlies, right? And so you can define two sets of longitudes. That is to say, a coordinate system which turns around in a particular time, and then another one which turns around in a different particular time. Those are referred to as system 1 and system 2 longitudes. There's also system 3 longitudes, which refers to the radio emissions which seem to come from inside the planet, at least some distance down into the atmosphere. Did I see a hand back there somewhere? If you raise your hand and I can't see you, which often happens to me, remember the flash shape is pretty much shining in my face. Don't sit there and suffer to yell question or yell funny looking or something like that.
When is this going to be?
Well, I'll give you the exact schedule, in fact. We've got it all right here. Is it happening? Voyager 1 will... Now, these are encounter dates. Please remember, this is not the beginning of the observations, which is months earlier in all cases. But these are the dates of closest approach, all right? Voyager 1 Jupiter encounter is March 5th of next year. So it's almost a year to the day from now. It's a little bit less than 1 year from today. Voyager 2 arrives at Jupiter on July 9th of next year, 4 months apart. Voyager 1 arrives at Saturn on November 13th of 1980. Voyager 2 arrives at Saturn, and again, these are closest approaches. The observations begin much earlier, on August 27th of 1981. So by then, they are 9 months apart. Voyager 2 arrives at Uranus, assuming that it goes there, on January 31st or January 30th, depending on which reference you use, of 1986. And I suspect the reason for the difference is that one is using Greenwich time, the other is using Pacific time. So probably the night of the 30th or 31st in our point of view. And if Voyager 2 goes on to Neptune, which for reasons that I mentioned almost certainly will not happen, it will arrive sometime in September, that is modern calculate the exact date, of 1989. Then they got a solar system, leave the solar system and send it across the orbit of Pluto, as I already mentioned, respectively in late 1987 and early and mid rather 1989. And they should be commandable if all goes well, if the spacecraft are still operating, and there's every reason to believe they will be, for up to 30 years after launch, by which time they will be 100 times as far from the Sun as the Earth is. Pluto, by comparison, is on the average, it's closer than average now, on the average Pluto is only 36 times as far from the Sun as the Earth is. So we're talking about being able to get data from the spacecraft on request by commanding the spacecraft somewhere around the year 2009 at a time when it will be 3 times as far from the Sun as Pluto. And after that, the spacecraft should remain audible. We'll be able to hear it, but it won't be able to hear us, in other words. See, we've got bigger antennae than it has. So we can hear its data, or at least its signal, long after it can pick up commanding on us. Should be able to do it, even using present-day receiver technology, as much as 100 years after launch, which is 300 astronomical units out. It's going a little bit more than 3 astronomical units per year after it leaves the solar system. And of course, even those times are tiny compared to the 40,000 years to the nearest star encounter. And even there, that's as soon as it is because the star is doing most of the work.
There's an obvious question to ask. Is there going to be any useful data that we can get from information that a spacecraft provided that...
Oh, from that far out, yes. I'm glad you asked that question because we may get the first observations of true interstellar space from that. Somewhere, the solar wind has got to end. We do not know where. Now, what's happening is the sun is moving through the
region of the galaxy that we're in, the closest with respect to the average of the nearby stars, at a speed of 12 miles a second in the general direction of the constellation Hercules. And the wind of that motion, so to speak, through the interstellar gas should compress the region within which the sun's magnetic field is bounded and within which the solar wind is held. On that side, the boundary is determined by the point where the pressure of the expanding solar wind becomes equal, as far down to be equal to the pressure of the interstellar gas. Okay? Now, of course, you're dealing, when I say pressure, you're dealing with gas of the order of one atom per cubic centimeter out there. By comparison, there are 10 to the 19th atoms per cubic centimeter in the air of this room. That means the number 1 followed by 19 zeros. So when I talk about pressure, you're using the term for a large region of space before it has any real meaning. Nevertheless, the heliosphere, which is not a sphere, the region within which the solar wind and sun's magnetic field will be confined, very much like the magnetosphere of a planet, only very much bigger, would be compressed on the side of the moving towards and elongated into a long tail on the side we're moving away from. Very much the way in the magnetosphere is, except this time it's the solar wind moving past it instead of the compression. And all this is familiar to those of you who were around the last time I talked about planetary magnetospheres. Okay, it so happens the two Voyagers are going out almost in the direction that the sun is heading, whereas Pioneer 10 is going almost along the tail, and Pioneer 11 is going in an intermediate direction. 11 might make it to the boundary of the heliosphere before we lose contact with it, which should be somewhere around the orbit of Uranus, or if we make a real effort, maybe as far as the orbit of Pluto. Somebody calculated a few years ago that if we use the biggest radio telescope on Earth, the 1,000-foot dish, in other words, a single antenna diameter of 3 football fields, in Arecibo, Puerto Rico, it should be barely possible to pick up Pioneer 10 or 11 at the distance of Pluto. But that will be really marginal. In fact, I haven't heard it discussed since, so there may not be any plans to bother to try. But the Voyagers are much more powerful, not to say you get them to 300 astronomical units out. So, the, if nothing fails, of course they're not designed to last anything like that long. But by now we've got so much experience with those spacecraft running out much longer than they last than they're designed to, that there is real confidence that they really will still be operating at that time. And of course, they'll still be faithfully sending back signals even after that, but no radio receiver on Earth could pick them up. At least the present technology. 100 years from now, we'll go out and listen to it on the next door. You know? Sure, all kinds of possibilities. So these may very well be the first true probes of interstellar space. And remember that they've got all the devices on them for analyzing atoms and fragments of atoms that hit the bandwidth. So we will get direct on-site measurement of the composition of the interstellar gas for the first time in history. That's what we're missing. That is very exciting. It's a bonus. It's not part of the mission. The mission is Jupiter and Saturn. Even Uranus is a bonus. But chances are very good that we'll get that.
If, of course, there are the funds to keep it going. That's the other problem.
In order now, you know, perhaps at the all test, the astronauts left on the moon still operating after all those years, were turned off on October 1st of last year because there was not enough money to keep getting the data from them. And it looks as though we are going to lose all four of the Viking spacecraft on March 1st of next year for the same reason. Still working magnificently, still sending back excellent data, can't get a few million dollars a year if it's necessary to keep getting the data, after spending $1 billion on them already. And that's the kind of thing that happens all the time. That's the sort of thing Representative Holden is into, which is what I was getting to.
Pioneer Jupiter, or rather Jupiter orbital probe,
is important for these reasons, but it's important for another reason too, which has nothing else whatsoever to do with its scientific value. This would be true no matter what planet is going to, no matter what it's doing. It is the only U.S. planetary mission that is currently planned. Which means that if it is killed, we have to fire all of that team so patiently built up over so many years. One of the prime national resources, in my opinion, that is simply throw away. As it is, even if JLP improves, you have to lose a good deal because it's only the one mission. And you don't have the excuse to keep sending all those people. But with JLP gone, everything is gone. So if Holland and his cronies can kill JLP, they have not only killed one mission, they have killed all future U.S. planetary capability. Forever. Or until such time as there is a complete turnabout in attitude, and then the team would have to be, a different team, different people of course, would have to be totally reassembled. It came very, very, very close with, of course, the usual total lack of publicity that was happening this year. I mean, past year. In fact, Boland is the chairman of the committee, and in general, the committee votes as the chairman wants, unless there are really good reasons against it. There are exceptions to that occasionally, and in fact, one exception, believe it or not, is Senator Brockmeyer's committee, the equivalent committee in the Senate, which regularly vote against the chairman. And that's just almost unheard of. And apparently, the reason for it, you know, Brockmeyer is also very anti-space. And when he got the chairmanship of the Senate Appropriations Committee, there were an awful lot of people who thought that's it for the space program. In fact, it has not had very much effect. And the reason is that regularly, Brockmeyer cast the only negative vote on a NASA appropriations bill which is going through his committee. And apparently the reason for that is that everybody, even the members of the committee, knows that Brockmeyer is an idiot. Or at least on this one particular subject. For all I know, they'd be very confident in other areas he's interested in, like banking and so forth. I just don't know, you know, I'm going to deal with it. But in this particular field, I feel qualified to be able to stand here and say in public he's an idiot. And there are others who said it too, and said stronger words. I like what the L5 News called a couple of issues back, Darth Brockmeyer. But in the case of Boland, apparently it's not quite that clear cut. And so what happened was, had a really weird situation in which the Senate had, okay, you have an asset appropriations bill, it goes to the committees of both houses, and then it's reported to the floor, right? And generally, the floor understands what the committee recommended. I mean, that's what the committees are for, right? So that every senator, every representative doesn't have to perform the impossible task of being an expert on every subject. You know, you get a few of them that are experts in a particular subject or explain to me, and you set them aside the committee, and you let them do your thinking for you in that area, unless there seems some really good strong reason to override it. So, in fact, this happened, and it so happened that the Senate and the House passed bills which were, you know, pretty similar. This is different here and different there. One of the ways in which they differed was the Senate had approved JLP. The House, because of Boland, had not. The Brockmeyer wasn't able to get a kill in his committee, but Boland in his committee was. All right. So they went to the floor, and the floor of the House did rubber stamp. And so the bills were reported out of the Senate, with JLP deleted. With JLP still in the Senate bill and deleted from the House bill. Well, I'm sure you know that in the future in such cases, you get a conference committee made of members of the respective committees in the two houses, which take the two bills, come together, work out a compromise bill, which is then, after the compromise, sent back to the two houses and almost always is simply rolled through. That's the way it works. In this particular case, a virtually unheard of thing happened. This has not happened since the early 1960s. They couldn't compromise on that one item. Everything else they were able to compromise on. But the Senate members of the conference committee had strong instructions that JLP was to live, and the House members had equally strong instructions that it was to die. And that was that. And nobody could figure a way out of the impasse. Well, when these things do happen, they also have a standard mechanism for coping with it. What they do is take this one item out of the bill, report the rest of the bill to the House and to the Senate, and that was done and went through. And then the one item they can't agree on is made a separate bill all by itself and is sent to the two chambers. That was done. Now, it didn't have to go to the Senate because the Senate already approved it. So what it came down to was, the full House was voting on whether or not to kill JLP. If they voted to kill it, it wasn't dead unless you could talk the Senate into voting to kill it. But if they voted to let it live, then it was okay because the Senate already voted to let it live. See what I mean? So it wasn't entirely like the death matter, it was really close. Now, it is virtually unheard of for the full House, or the full Senate for that matter, to vote against the wishes of a powerful committee chairman. And so it looked very much as though the House was indeed going to vote it down. At the very last minute, and I mean literally 2 days before the House was to get it through, the planetary science community finally got into action. And as a result of a frantic last-minute telephone drive in which a few people who realized what was happening phoned a whole lot of planetary scientists and some other interested people and said, for heaven's sake, get all your congressmen back and have and tell them to vote for that bill. As a result of that, all of a sudden, Congress was deluged with letters and telegrams and phone calls from planetary scientists. And believe it or not, they voted against Poland's wishes and in favor of JOP by an enormous margin, something like 240 to 10. And Poland, of course, just I mean, it just doesn't happen, you know, with the voice of the people over a committee chair. That just isn't the way our democracy works. And Poland isn't going to get caught by surprise next year because he's going to have the whole year to think this through. In other words, you know, this year was just routine and he hadn't done very much preparation for it. So we are going to have, I think, the greatest crisis, the greatest political crisis that the United States space program, or at least the planetary exploration branch of it, has ever faced coming up next year with, I am quite sure, zero publicity. What is the NASA budget? This year it is just over $4 billion. That's about 1% of the federal budget. Tomorrow's major item in the federal budget. How education welfare spends that much every 9 days, like the question is,
how could we find out when things like this are going on? Could we get our
That's a very excellent question, and my problem is what I just told you is virtually everything I know. My knowledge of politics is very, very, very much, and, you know, this, of course, is one of the problems, and it's true of most of the people who are actually in the field of the scientists that are doing research, and their interest in it is very slight. They don't want to get involved in things like this. And my political ability is not very great. You know, if I wrote my congressman, I'd probably turn him against it. But for those of you who want to, it's not asking a question, it's telling you why I don't go into a whole lot. What I would suggest, though, is you certainly do a lot more work than just have to be online about it.
I was thinking about that. It's obviously impossible for us to find out about the president's playoffs.
No, it's not. Write your congressman, explain to where you're interested, explain that you have just learned that Jupiter orbit approach was almost killed this year and with it the whole U.S. planetary capability, and you do not want to see this happen next year, and request your congressman to keep you informed. You know, and that's what they have to ask for. That's what they're aiming for. Obviously, congressman tells me that they're going to write a letter every year for the winning, but they're aiming for them. I would assume it. Or, you know, phone their office every once in a while, and bug them every once in a while, and say, listen, this is going to happen. It'll happen. It's a series of processes, of course. First the bill goes into the various committees, goes out, even before that goes to OMB, and where the real squad is done, and citizens have no control over that. That is what a really interesting
and so forth, and sidewalks and NASA budget and all the other entries of the budget are going to be.
Then it goes to the various committees, and that's the point at which you can start getting involved. And then it goes to the full board of the house. So, you know, here it goes in the papers. When does this beginning to happen? Or is it the getting such a Congress is all the time? And of course, don't forget, you got one congressman and you got two senators. There are three people on the government. The Senate side is important, too. Question here. By the way, we got a couple people leaving. Could you give us the lights there on the way out, because this is my last slide? Or in fact, Robert should turn on the room lights there, Charles.
There is time for
meeting tonight. Thank you.
Thank you.
There are no plans for landing on Titan at the moment. It will be way premature. We have no idea what the surface is like. I guess we just sort of ended the lecture. We are now in the question session without having realized it. So that's what I'm saying. Yeah. We've got to be out of here by the way. 11:30, Bob? I think 11:30 is the magic number of sure you're going to do 100. Yeah, no, I mean, 10:23 now. I'm asking what is the time that we have to be out. I think it's 11:30. Oh, all right. Well, fine. We got 10 minutes. Okay, who was saying what?
Robert's explanation of why the moon is
seen in orbit. No, I didn't. Oh, I'm sorry. I guess I did. Yeah, that's right. That's right. Oh, Lord. Okay. You know about conservation of anger and momentum? You know what that means? Oh, thank you. Now I can make it free. Okay. Just some rotating systems. Third year, moon revolves around. Moon exerts tidal force on the Earth. Friction of those tides allows the Earth to slow down the rotation of the Earth. Okay? The friction is within the Earth system, but the Earth moon system has no friction. Right? And so if the Earth loses angular momentum, that angular momentum has got to go into the moon. Okay?
Correct.
I don't know whether I have to take up the questions that we have, but I can explain why the helium business will not make any difference if you're using electronic sound reproduction.
Oh, sure. I can listen.
The reason that helium raises that when you're breathing helium oxygen, your voice goes up. Is because it's the helium molecules themselves that are originating the vibration. Originating
the sound. Okay. The amount of energy put into them, my sight has your vocal cords, makes them go a lot faster. But if you've got an electronic sound reproduction system, all that you're doing is mimicking the vibration of, say, the cone of the speaker,
or whatever, and the frequency of vibration is therefore dependent upon the speaker, and it can... Now, wait, when you talk to me, your vocal cords vibrate, shutting in the air may get vibrations. Well, it's actually the air that is originating the vibration.
That's interesting. What you're saying is what the larynx really does is not so much make vocal cords vibrate as make ear vibrate.
Right.
I didn't know that.
That's why if you've got...
You learn so much being a popular legend.
Yeah. If you've got waterproof speakers, you can play it underwater, and the fact that water mutes noise and vibration, the frequencies come out the same and are not tremendously dulled and lowered. I say that water is so much more dense.
Fascinating. Thank you.
So, if they built a speaker that works by pushing it rather than going into a hole, very quick.
Great. Other questions?
Are Voyager going to look at Saturn's moon, Yapetus?
Yapetus is the one moon that I just claimed forgot to tell you about, and it's the one that is six times brighter on one side than the other. It's black on one side, white on the other, we don't know why. We will get pictures of Yapetus. They're not terribly good, something of the order of 30-mile resolution. That may or may not be enough to tell us. I mean, after all, that's better than the best pictures of Mars we have from Earth-based telescopes, and you can at least see the pattern of the dark areas there. If it turns out that the white area, say, is perfectly circular, well then, and you got some shadows on one side, well, you know, some giant crater or say the dark area is that way, and the crater form is blasted away with snow or something like that. Let's take you back, Kurt. You asked a bunch. Besides, you're prettier than you are. The orbit of Chiron now. Well, in fact, it is officially still an object hole. It's going to be called Chiron because that's the name the discoverer wants. Chiron is a centaur, by the way. And he suggested that other such objects are discovered that we could name them for other centaurs. There are a whole flock of them. Its orbit is not as tilted as Pluto's, but it is more tilted than that of any other planet except Mercury. And that is, it is 7 degrees, which is the tilt of the orbit of Mercury.
By the way, I forgot to mention also the period. I know you're collecting calorie information. The period is 50.8 Earth years, as compared to 29 for Saturn and 86 for Uranus. Oh, sorry, 84 for Uranus.
Unrelated to your period question.
Okay.
Where did you get your data for the helium transfer on the surface?
Helium transfer on the surface.
You talked about shedding of the tenuous helium atmosphere and replacement every 4 hours.
Oh, Mercury.
Yeah.
The final report that was in Science Magazine. Yeah, a few months after the flyby.
Okay, I've got it. I'll look it up.
Yeah, it's in there.
I was wondering why we have to ask ourselves.
It is not a broken up planet. There are both differentiated and undifferentiated asteroids, and they couldn't have all come from the same planet. It is possible that they all came from a dozen or so separate small bodies. But even if you add them all together, you don't get a decent-sized moon, let alone a planet. So it must have been just a thin region of the solar nebula, the cloud of gas and dust the solar system formed out of. You know, that's unsatisfactory, and ask me again when we've got sample return missions from a couple of dozen asteroids, and I'll give you a better answer. I hope. I don't know. Actually, if we get words on understanding the origin of the moon by going there and finding out that none of the three theories work. And now we can prove the moon couldn't possibly have originated. Okay, I got time for one more. Let's take somebody ahead and ask a question.
About a year and a half ago, when the Vikings landed on the moon.
The Renaissance.
All right.
Yeah.
They, of course, the years there are 2 years long.
Yeah, almost 2 years.
And they were telling us that it was the middle of summer there at that time.
Correct.
So it's probably springtime by now.
It is.
And they're saying that during the winter months, there's supposed to be snow or something that comes down out of the atmosphere.
Right.
Is anything like
it
that?
Is the atmosphere.
You know, funny thing, it is the atmosphere. The air is made of carbon dioxide and freezes and falls to the ground. And Viking Lander 2 is one farther north, about the same latitude as Isle Royale here in Michigan. Should have been just the edge of the polar cap. Well, it turned out, temperature that you need for carbon dioxide to freeze and Martian atmospheric pressure is -190 Fahrenheit. All through the winter, you had temperatures of -187, -188, -189, -186, -187. One day only did it reach -190. Needless to say, that was not one of the days in which the computer had been pre-programmed to send back a picture. And so we never did see it. We gave up on seeing the frost. And then the temperature began to warm, and all of a sudden, one morning, we woke up and there was a picture with patches of frost all over the ground. Far too warm to be frozen carbon dioxide. Humidity far too low for it to be frozen water. So what it is, we have no idea. Pictures been all over the way. The current, the Mars issue of Scientific American has an article by some of the Viking Lander imaging team on the surface of Mars. I have not seen it, but I've seen the authors and I guarantee it's excellent. And it's reproducing that cross right here. Yeah, part of what Scientific American is doing is every few months getting more Viking articles. We've already got Viking biology and more of it. Now we've got Viking surface geology and maybe there'll be some more. In fact, we've already had that this year too. That's the March issue, which is not on the newsstand yet, but it's subscription that arrived. We might have. Came in yesterday. Scientific American. Scientific American. Science News has a picture reproduced also. Two pictures actually. A black and white one, and they said they have to have a color one program, and they both showed it. When I thought about the possibility that it might have been the bus provider, didn't seem likely because we went through the whole loop from a single change all the landscape, but you know, it's possible. It does look great. And the color picture is all that question is white. So, where is my tape thing?
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much. Hope to see you next week. Next month, rather.